Chapter 10 All Souls in Peril 1 By the 17th of Festal, Jean had come to dread the sight and smell of the ship's vinegar as much as he'd come to appreciate his glimpses of her lieutenant. His morning task, on most days, was to fill one bucket with the foul red stuff and another with seawater, and set to swabbing the deck and bulkheads along the full length of the main deck, at least where he could reach. Fore and aft were long compartments called crew berths, and one would be in use at any given time, crammed with 4 or 5 dozen people in and out of hammocks, their snores mingling like the growls of caged beasts. That berth Jean would carefully avoid, instead swabbing out ship's stores, what the crew called the delicates' room, for its rack of glass bottles under netting, the main deck hold and armoury, and the empty crew berth, though even when empty each berth contained a mess of barrels, crates and nettings that had to be laboriously shifted. Once the reek of watered vinegar was fully mingled with the usual below-deck stench of old food, bad liquor and all things unwashed, Jean would usually move throughout the lowest two decks, the orlop and the bilge, swinging a large yellow alchemical light before him to help dissipate the miasmas that caused disease. Dracasha was a great one for the health of her crew. Most of the sailors pierced their ears with copper to ward off cataracts and drank pinches of white sand in their ale to strengthen their bellies against rupture. The lower decks were lighted at least twice a day, much to the amusement of the ship's cats. Unfortunately, this meant climbing, crawling, scrambling, and shoving past all manner of obstacles, including busy crewfolk. Jean was always careful to be polite and make his obeisance by nodding as he passed. This crew was always in motion. This ship was always alive. The more Jean saw and learned on the Poison Orchid, the more convinced he became that the maintenance schedule he'd set as first mate of the Red Messenger had been hopelessly naive. No doubt Caldras would have spoken up eventually, had he lived long enough to notice. There seemed to be no such thing, in Captain Dracasha's opinion, as a state of adequate repair for a ship at sea. What was checked or inspected one watch was checked again the next, and the next, day after day. What was braced was then rebraced. What could be mended was remended. The pump and capstan mechanisms were greased daily with fat scraped from the cooking pots. The masts were slushed top to bottom with the same brown gunk for protection against the weather. Sailors wandered in constant attentive parties, inspecting plank seams or wrapping canvas around rigging where the ropes chafed against one another. The Orchids were divided into two watches, red and blue. They would work in 6-hour shifts, one watch minding the ship while the other rested. The red watch, for example, had duty from noon till the 6th hour of the evening, and would come back on duty from midnight till the 6th hour of the morning. Crew on the off watch could do as they pleased, unless the call of all hands summoned them to the deck for some strenuous or dangerous undertaking. The scrub watch didn't fit into this scheme. The former men of the Red Messenger were worked from dawn to dusk, and took their meals after they were dismissed, rather than around noon with the actual crew. For all their grumbling, Jean didn't get the sense that the Orchids genuinely resented their new shipmates. In fact, he suspected that the ex-messengers were taking up most of the less interesting chores, leaving the Orchids that much more time to sleep, or mend personal effects, or gamble, or fuck without a hint of shame in their hammocks or under their blankets. The lack of privacy aboard ship was still a major astonishment to Jean. He was neither a prude nor a virgin, but his idea of the right place had always involved stone walls and a firmly locked door. A lock would mean little on a ship like this, where most any noise was a shared noise. There were a pair of men on the blue watch who could be heard from the taffrail if they were doing it in the forward berth, and a woman on the red watch who screamed the damnedest things in Vadran, usually just as Jean was drifting off to sleep on the deck above her. He and Locke had puzzled over her grammar and concluded that she didn't actually speak Vadran. Sometimes her performances were followed by applause. That aside, the crew seemed to take pride in their discipline. Jean witnessed no fights, few serious arguments, and no out-of-place drunkenness. Beer or wine was had in a respectable fashion at every meal, and by some complicated scheme that Jean had yet to work out, each member of the crew was allowed, about once a week, to go on what was called the Merry Watch, a sort of watch within a watch. The Merry Watch would set up on the main deck and be allowed a bit of freedom at the ship's waist, especially for throwing up. They could drink more or less as they saw fit, and were excused even from all-hands calls until they'd recovered. "It's not exactly what I expected," said Jean, as Ezri stood at the larboard rail one morning, pretending not to watch him touch up the grey paint on the bottom of the ship's smallest boat. She did that every now and again. Was he imagining things? Was it his quoting Lucano? He'd avoided quoting anything else at her, even when the opportunity had presented itself. Better to be a mystery in his book than to make a cheap refrain of something that had caught her attention. 13 gods, he thought with a start. Am I angling myself for a pass at her? Is she...
Pardon? She said.
Jean smiled. Somehow he'd guessed she wouldn't mind his speaking without invitation. Your ship. It's not exactly what I expected, from what I read.
From what you read?
She laughed, crossed her arms, and regarded him almost slyly.
What did you read?
Let me think. He dipped his brush in the grey alchemical slop and tried to look busy. 7 years between the gale and the lash.
Benedictus Montcalm, she said. Read that one. Mostly bullshit. I think he traded drinks for stories off real sailors until he had his fill.
How about True and Accurate History of the Wanton Red Flag?
Suzette Villaducasi. I know her.
Know her?
Know of her. Crazy old bitch wound up in Port Prodigal. Scribes for coppers, drinks every coin she gets. Barely speaks decent Therin anymore. Just haunts the gutter and curses her old publishers.
Those are all the books I can remember, said Jean. Not much of a taste for histories, I'm afraid. So, how did you manage to read everything you have?
Ah, she said, tossing her hair backward with a flick of her neck. She wasn't scrawny, thought Jean. No angles on Ezri, just healthy curves and muscle.
Had to be healthy to knock him down as she had, even by surprise.
Out here, the past is a currency, Jerome. Sometimes it's the only one we have.
Mysterious.
Sensible.
You already know a bit about me.
And fair's fair, is it? Thing is, I'm a ship's officer and you're a dangerous unknown.
That sounds promising.
I thought so too, she smiled. More to the point, I'm a ship's officer and you're scrub watch. You're not even real yet.
She framed him with her hands and squinted.
You're just a sort of hazy something on the horizon.
Well, he said, and aware that he sounded like a nitwit even as he repeated himself. Ah, well.
But you were curious.
I was.
About the ship?
Oh, yeah, I was. I just wondered, now that I've seen a fair bit of it.
Where's the singing? Where's the dancing on the yardarms? Where's the ale casks fore and aft? Where's the drinking and puking sunrise to sunset?
More or less. Not exactly a navy, you know.
Drakasha is former navy. Cyrune. She doesn't talk about it much, but she doesn't try to hide her accent anymore. She did once.
Cyrune, thought Jean, an island empire even more easterly than Jerem and Jeresh. Proud and insular, dark-skinned folk who took their ships seriously. If Drakasha was one of them, she'd come from a tradition of sea officers that some said was as old as the Therin throne. Cyrune, he said. That explains some things. I thought the past was a currency.
She'd have let you have that bit for free, said Esri. Trust me, if history's a coin, she's sitting on a god's damned fortune.
So she, bends the ship to her old habits?
More like we let ourselves be bent. Esri gestured to him to keep painting, and he returned to work. Brass sea captains are special. They have status, on the water and off. There's a council of them in Prodigal, but each ship, the brethren sort of go their own way. Some captains get elected. Some only rule when it's time to take arms. With Jakasha, she rules because we know she's our best chance. At anything, they don't fuck around in Cyrene.
So you keep naval watches and drink like nervous husbands and mind your manners?
You don't approve?
God's blood, I damn well approve. It's just tidier than I imagined is all.
You wouldn't call anything we do naval if you'd ever served on a real ship of war. Most of our crew have, and this is a slacker's paradise by comparison. We keep our habits because most of us have been aboard other pirate ships too. Seen the leaks that gain a little bit every day. Seen the mechanisms rusting. Seen the rigging fraying. What good slacking all the time if the ship comes apart beneath you while you sleep?
So you're a prudent bunch.
Yeah. Look, the sea either makes you prudent or it kills you. Drakasha's officers take an oath. We're sworn that this ship goes down in battle or by the will of the gods, not for want of work or canvas or cord. That's a holy vow. She stretched. And not for want of paint, either. Give the whole thing another coat and look sharp about it.
Officers. Jean reviewed the Orchid's officers as he worked, to keep his mind off Esri. There was Drakasha, obviously. She kept no watch, but appeared when and as she saw fit. She seemed to be on deck at least half the day, and materialized like magic when anything interesting happened. Beneath her, Esri. Damn it, no thoughts concerning Esri. Not now. Mum Chance, the sailing master, and his little crew of trusted wheelhands. Drakasha might allow ordinary crewfolk to hold the helm in steady weather, but for any operation of skill, it was Mum and his bunch or nobody. Roughly equal with Mum were the quartermaster, currently assigned to the Red Messenger, and the physicker, Tregan, who would likely never admit to being equal with anyone who didn't have a temple with their name on it. Drakasha had the great cabin, naturally, and the four highest officers were allowed little closet rooms in the companionway, canvas-walled things like his old cabin. Then there was a carpenter, a sailmaker, a cook, and a boatswain. The only privilege of being a petty officer seemed to be the right to boss a few other crew folk about from time to time. There was also a pair of under-lieutenants, Jean supposed. Esri called them her watch chiefs, and they were Esri when Esri wasn't around. Utgar had the red watch, and a woman called Nazrin led the blue, but Jean had yet to meet her, since she'd been entrusted with the messenger's prize crew. It seemed that all the menial back-and-forth mucking about was giving Jean, and the rest of the scrub watch, the chance to learn the ship's hierarchy, along with its layout. He supposed that was by design. The weather had been consistent since their capture. Steady light breezes from the northeast, clouds that came and went like a tavern dancer's favour, endless low waves that made the sea gleam like a million-faceted sapphire. The sun was a pounding heat by day, and enclosure stifled them at night, but Jean was conditioned to this work by now. He was as brown as Paolo and Cosetta. Locke, too, seemed to be making the best of it, tanned and bearded and genuinely wiry for once, rather than merely slender. His size and an unwise boast about his agility had gotten him assigned to mast-slushing duty, foremast and main, each and every morning. Their food still came late after each long day, and though charmless, it was more than ample. They had a full liquor ration now, too. As much as Jean hated to admit it, even to himself, he didn't mind this turn of events so very much. He could work and sleep in confidence that the people ruling the ship knew their business. He and Locke no longer had to run everything on improvisation and prayer. if not for the damned log, with its relentless record of day after day passing them by, day after day of the antidote waning, it would have been a good time. A good and timeless interval with Lieutenant Del Mastro to puzzle over. But neither he nor Locke could stop counting the days. 2. On the 18th of Festal, Bald Mazooka snapped. He'd given no warning. Though he'd been sullen in the undercastle each night, he was one among many tired and short-tempered men, and he'd made no further threats toward anyone, crew or scrub watch. It was dusk, 2 or 3 hours into the Blue Watch's duty, and lanterns were going up across the ship. Jean was sitting next to Locke by the chicken coops, unravelling old rope into its component yarns. Locke was shredding these into a pile of rough brown fibres. Tarred, this stuff would become oakum, and be used for everything from caulking seams to stuffing pillows. It was a miserably tedious job, but the sun was almost gone, and the end of duty for the day was nearly at hand. There was a clatter from somewhere near the undercastle, followed by swearing and laughter. Bald Mazooka stomped into sight, carrying a mop and a bucket, with a crewman Jean didn't recognize at his heels. The crewman said something else that Jean didn't catch, and then it happened. Mazooka whirled and flung the heavy bucket at him, catching him right in the face. The crewman fell on his backside, stunned.
"Gods damn you!" Mazooka cried. "Do you think I'm a fucking child?"
The crewman fumbled at his belt for a weapon, a short club, Jean saw. But Mazooka's blood was up, and the crewman was still recovering from the blow. In a moment, Mazooka had kicked him in the chest and snatched the club for himself. He raised it above his head, but that was as far as he got. 3 or 4 crew folk hit him simultaneously, knocking him to the deck and wrestling the club from his hand. Heavy footsteps beat rapidly from the quarterdeck to the waist. Captain Dracasha had come without being summoned. As she flew past, Jean, his rope work quite forgotten, felt his stomach flutter. She had it. She wore it like a cloak. The same aura that he'd once seen in Kappa Barsavi, something that slept inside until it was drawn out by anger or need, so sudden and so terrible. Death itself was beating a tread upon the ship's planks. Dracasha's crewfolk had Mazooka up and pinned by the arms. The man who'd been hit by the bucket had retrieved his club and was rubbing his head nearby. Zamira came to a halt and pointed at him.
"Explain yourself, Thomas."
I was... Sorry, Captain. Just having some fun."
"He's been hounding me all fucking afternoon," said Mazooka,
subdued but nowhere near calm.
"Hasn't done a lick of work. Just follows me around, kicks my bucket, takes my tools, messes up my shit and sets me to fixing it again."
"True, Thomas."
It was just fun, Captain. Teasing the scrub watch. Didn't mean nothing. I'll stop."
Dracasha moved so fast, Thomas didn't even have time to flinch until he was already on his way back to the deck, his nose broken. Jean had noted the elegant upward sweep of her arm and the precise use of the palm. He'd been on the receiving end of that sort of blow at least twice in his life. Thomas, stupid ass that he was, had his sympathy. Said Thomas, spraying blood.
"The scrub watch are like tools," said Dracasha. "I expect them to be kept in a useful trim, maintained. You want to have fun, you make sure it's responsible fun. I'm halving your share of the Red Messenger loot, and your share of the sale."
She gestured to the women standing behind him.
"You two, haul him aft and find Scholar Tregane."
As Thomas was being dragged toward the quarterdeck for a surprise visit to the ship's physica, Dracasha turned to Mazooka.
"You heard my rules. First night you were on my ship."
"I know. I'm sorry, Captain Dracasha. He just..."
"You did hear. You did hear what I said, and you understood."
"I did. I was angry.
Death to touch a weapon. I made that clear as a cloudless sky, and you did it anyway."
"Look!"
I've got no use for you, she said, and her right arm darted out to close around Mazuka's throat. The crew folk released him, and he locked his hands around Drakasha's forearm to no avail. She began dragging him toward the starboard rail.
Out here, you lose your head, you make one dumb goddamned mistake, you can take the whole ship down. If you can't keep your wits when you've been told what's at stake, clear and simple, you're just ballast.
Kicking and gagging, Mazuka tried to fight back, but Drakasha hauled him inexorably toward the side of the weather deck. About 2 yards from the rail, she gritted her teeth, drew her right arm back, and flung Mazuka forward, putting the full power of hip and shoulder into the push. He hit hard, flailing for balance, and toppled backward. A second later, there was the sound of a splash.
This ship has ballast enough.
Crew folk and scrub watch alike ran to the starboard rail. After a quick glance at Locke, Jean got up to join them. Drakasha remained where she was, arms at her side. Her sudden rage evaporated. In that, too, she seemed like Barsavi. Jean wondered if she would spend the rest of the night sullen and brooding, or even drinking. The ship had been making a steady 4 or 5 knots, and Mazuka didn't appear to be a strong swimmer. He was already 5 or 6 yards to the side of the ship, and 15 or 20 yards back, off the quarterdeck. His arms and head bobbed against the rippling darkness of the waves, and he hollered for help. Dusk. Jean shuddered. A hungry time on the open sea. The hard light of day drove many things deep beneath the waves, made the water nearly safe for hours on end. All that changed at twilight.
"Shall we fish him out, Captain?"
A crewman had stepped up beside her, and he spoke in a voice so low that only those nearby could hear.
"No," said Drakasha.
She turned and began to walk slowly aft.
"Sail on. Something will be along for him soon enough."
3. On the 19th, at 12:30, Drakasha shouted for Locke to come to her cabin. Locke ran aft as fast as he could, visions of Thomas and Mazuka vivid in his mind.
"Ravel, what the unhallowed hells is this?"
Locke paused to take in the scene. She'd rigged her table in the center of the cabin. Paolo and Cosetta were seated across from one another, staring at Locke, and a deck of playing cards was spread in an unfathomable pattern between them. A silver goblet was tipped over in the middle of the table, a goblet too large for little hands. Locke felt a flutter of anxiety in the pit of his stomach, but looked closer nonetheless. As he'd suspected, a mouthful or so of pale brown liquor had spilled onto the tabletop from the goblet and fallen across a card. That card had dissolved into a puddle of soft, completely unmarked grey material.
"You took the cards out of my chest," he said.
"The ones in the double-layered oilcloth parcel."
"Yes."
"And you were drinking a fairly strong liquor with your meal. One of your children spilled it."
"Caramel brandy, and I spilled it myself."
She produced a dagger and poked at the grey material. Although it had a liquid sheen, it was hard and solid, and the tip of the dagger slid off it as though it were granite.
"What the hell is this? It's like alchemical cement."
"It is alchemical cement. You didn't notice that the cards smelled funny?"
"Why the hell would I smell playing cards?"
She frowned.
"Children, don't touch these any more. In fact, go sit on your bed until Mummy can wash your hands."
"It's not dangerous," said Locke.
"I don't care," she said. "Paolo, Cosetta, put your hands in your laps and wait for Mummy."
"They're not really cards," said Locke. "They're alchemical resin wafers, paper thin and flexible. The card designs are actually painted on. You wouldn't believe how expensive they were."
"Nor would I care. What the hell are they for?"
"Isn't it obvious? Dip one in strong liquor and it dissolves in a few seconds. Suddenly you've got a little pat of alchemical cement. Mash up as many cards as you need. The stuff dries in about a minute, hard as steel."
"Hard as steel?"
She eyed the grey splotch on her fine lacquered tabletop. How does it come off?
It doesn't. There's no solvent, at least not outside of an alchemist's lab.
What? God's damn it, Ravel!
Captain, you're being unfair. I didn't ask you to take those cards out and play with them, nor did I spill liquor on them.
You're right, said Drakasha with a sigh.
She looked tired, Locke thought. The faint frown lines around her mouth looked as though they'd had a long recent workout.
Gather these up and throw them overboard.
Captain, please! Please! Locke held his hands out toward her. Not only are they expensive, they'd be damned impossible to duplicate. It'd take months. Let me just roll them back up in oilcloth and put them in the chest. Please think of them as part of my papers.
What do you use them for?
They're just part of my little bag of tricks, he said. All I have left of it, really. One last important little trick. I swear to you, they're absolutely no threat to you and your ship. You have to spill booze on them, and even then they're just an annoyance. Look, if you save them for me and find me some knives with scalpel edges, I'll devote all my time to getting that shit off your table, prying from the sides, even if it takes all week. Please!
As it turned out, it took him 10 hours, scraping away with infinite care atop the forecastle as though he were performing surgery. He worked without rest, first by sunlight and then by the glow of multiple lanterns, until the devilishly hard stuff had been scraped off with nothing but a ghost upon the lacquer to show for it. When he finally claimed his minuscule sleeping space, he knew his hands and forearms would ache well into the next day. It was worth it, and had been worth every minute of work, to preserve the existence of that deck of cards. 4. On the 20th, Drakasha gave up on the easterly course and put them west by north with the wind on the starboard beam. The weather held. They cooked by day and sweated by night, and the ship sailed beneath streams of flit wraiths that hung over the water like arches of ghostly green light. On the 21st, as the promise of dawn was just greying the eastern sky, they had their chance to prove themselves. Locke was knocked out of a too short sleep by an elbow to the ribs. He woke to confusion. The men of the scrub watch were shifting, stumbling, and muttering all around him.
"Sail ho!" said Jean. "Heard it from the masthead just a minute ago," said someone near the door. 2 points off the starboard quarter. That's well east and a little north of us, hull down."
"That's good," said Jabril, yawning. "The dawn glimpse."
Dawn? It still seemed dark, and Locke rubbed his sleep-blurred eyes. Dawn already? Since I no longer have to pretend to know what the hell I'm doing, what's a dawn glimpse?
Sun's coming up over the horizon, see?
Jabril seemed to relish the chance to lecture Locke.
Over in the east, we're still in shadow over here, to the west of them. Hard to see us, but we got a good eye on them with that faint light behind their masts, savvy?
Right, said Locke. Seems like a good thing.
We're for her, said Aspel. We'll move in and take her. This ship is loaded with crew and Drakasha's a bloody-handed bitch.
It's a fight for us, said Struva.
We'll go first.
Aye, and prove ourselves, said Aspel. Prove ourselves and be quits with this scrub-watch shit.
Don't be tying silver ribbons on your cock just yet, said Jabril. We don't know her heading, or what speed she makes, or what her best point of sailing is. She might be a ship of war, might even be part of a squadron.
Be fucked, Jabby, said someone without real malice. Don't you want to be gone from scrub-watch?
Hey, time comes to board her, I'll row the boat naked and attack the bastards with my good fucking looks. Just wait and see if she's prey, is all I'm saying.
There was noise and commotion on deck. Orders were shouted. The men at the entrance strained to hear and see everything.
Del Mastro's sending people up the lines, said one of them. Looks like we're going to come north a few points. They're doing it quick-like.
Nothing's more suspicious than a change of sail if they see us, said Jabril. She wants us to be nearer their course before we're spotted, so it looks natural.
Minutes passed. Locke blinked and settled back down against his familiar bulkhead. If action wasn't imminent, there was always time for a few more minutes of sleep. From the groaning and shuffling around him, he wasn't alone in that opinion. He awoke a few minutes later. The sky seen through the ventilation hatch was lighter grey, to Lieutenant Del Mastro's voice coming from the undercastle entrance.
Where you are for now! Keep quiet and out of sight! It's about 5 minutes to the switchover from red to blue, but we're suspending regular watches for action. We'll be sending red down in bits and pieces, and half of blue will come up to replace them. We want to look like a merchant brig, not a prowler with a heavy crew.
Locke craned his neck to look out over the shadowy shapes around him. Just past Del Mastro, in the pre-dawn murk, he could see crew folk at the waist wrestling several large barrels toward the ship's larboard rail.
Smoke barrels on deck! Called a woman. No open flames on deck! Shouted Ezri. No smoking! Alchemical lights only! Pass the word!
Minutes passed, and the light of dawn grew steadily. Locke nonetheless found his eyelids creeping back downward. He sighed, relaxed, and...
On deck there! Came a shout from the foremast head. Send to the captain, she's got 3 masts, and she's northwest by west. Topsails!
Aye, 3 masts, northwest by west. Topsails! Shouted Ezri. How does she bear?
Broad on the starboard beam, after point maybe.
Keep sharp. Is she still hull down?
Aye.
The moment she lifts her skirts over that horizon, you peek and tell us what's under them.
Ezri returned to the undercastle and pounded loudly on the bulkhead beside the entrance.
Scrub watch! Rouse up! Stretch your legs and use the crap lines, then get back under here. Be quick! We'll be fighting or running soon enough. Best to have your innards in good order.
It was less like moving with a crowd than being squeezed from a tube. Locke found himself pushed onto deck, and he curled his back and stretched. Jean did likewise, then stepped up beside Del Mastro. Locke raised an eyebrow. The little lieutenant seemed to tolerate Jean's conversation to the same extent that she disdained his. So long as one of them was getting information from her, he supposed.
Do you really think we'll be running? Asked Jean.
I'd prefer not.
Del Mastro squinted over the rail, but even from Locke's perspective, the new ship couldn't be seen on deck just yet.
You know, said Jean, it's to be expected that you won't see anything from down there. You should let me put you on my shoulders.
A short joke, said Del Mastro. How remarkably original. I've never heard the like in all my days. I'll have you know I'm the tallest of all my sisters.
Sisters, said Jean. Interesting. A bit of your past for free?
Shit, she said, scowling. Leave me alone, Valora. It's going to be a busy morning.
Men were returning from the crap lines. Now that the press had lessened, Locke climbed the stairs and made his way forward to do his own business. He had sufficient unpleasant experience by now to elbow his way to the weather side. Damned unfortunate things could happen to those on the lee crap lines in any kind of wind. Of the little wooden brace which crossed the bowsprit just a yard or two out from the forepeak. It had ratlines hanging beneath it like a miniature yardarm, and against these Locke braced his feet while he undid his breeches. Waves pounded white against the bow, and spray rose to splash the backs of his legs.
Gods, he said, to think that pissing could be such an adventure.
On deck there, came the cry from the foremast a moment later. She's a flute, she is, round and fat. Holding course and sail as before. What colours? None to be seen, Lieutenant.
A flute, Locke recognized the term. A round-sterned merchantman with a homely curved bow. Handy for cargo, but a brig like the Orchid could dance around it at will. No pirate or military expedition would make use of such a vessel. As soon as they could draw her in, it seemed they'd have their fight.
"Huh," he muttered, "and here I am, caught with my britches down."
5. The sun rose molten behind their target, framing the low black shape in a half-circle of crimson. Locke was on his knees at the starboard rail of the forecastle, trying to stay unobtrusive. He squinted and put a hand over his eyes to cut the glare. The eastern sky was a bonfire aura of pink and red. The sea was like liquid ruby spreading in a stain from the climbing sun. A dirty black smear of smoke rose from the lee side of the Poison Orchid's waist, a few yards wide, an ominous intrusion into the clean dawn air. Lieutenant Del Mastro was tending the smoke barrels herself. The Orchid was making way under topsails with her main and forecourses furled. Conveniently, it was both a logical plan of sail for this breeze and the first precaution they would have taken if the ship were really on fire.
"Come on, you miserable twits," said Jean, who was seated beside him. "Glance left for Perelandro's sake."
"Maybe they do see us," said Locke. "Maybe they just don't give a damn."
"They haven't changed a sail," said Jean, "or we would have heard about it from the lookouts. They must be the most incurious, myopic, dim-witted buggers that ever set canvas to mast."
"On deck there!" The foremast lookout sounded excited. "Send to the captain! She's turning to larboard!"
"How far?" Del Mastro stepped away from her smoke barrels. "Is she coming about to head right for us?"
"No, she's come about 3 points around."
"They want to have a closer look," said Jean, "but they're not hopping into the hammock with us just yet."
There was a shout from the quarterdeck, and a moment later Del Mastro blew her whistle 3 times.
"Scrub watch! Scrub watch to the quarterdeck!"
They hurried aft, past crewfolk removing well-oiled bows from canvas covers and stringing them. As Del Mastro had promised, about half the usual watch was on deck. Those involved in preparing weapons were crouched down or hiding behind the masts and the chicken coops. Drakasha was waiting for them at the quarterdeck rail, and she started speaking the moment they arrived.
"They still have time and room enough to put about. It's a flute, and I doubt they could run from us forever in any weather. But they could make us work for the catch. My guess is 6 or 7 hours. But who wants to be bored for that long? We'll pose as a charter brig on fire and see if we can't entice them to do the sociable thing."
"I offered a chance to prove yourselves, so you're the teeth of the trap. You'll fight first. Good on you if you come back. If you don't want to fight, get under the forecastle and stay scrub watch until we're quits with you."
"As for me, I woke up hungry this morning. I mean to have that fat little prize. Who among you would fight for a place on my ship?"
Locke and Jean thrust their arms into the air along with everyone nearby. Locke glanced quickly around and saw that nobody seemed to be declining their chance.
"Good," said Drakasha. "We've 3 boats, seating about 30. You'll have them. Your task will be to look innocent at first. Stay near the Orchid. At the signal, you'll dash out and attack from the south."
"Captain," said Jabril, "what if we can't take her ourselves?"
"If numbers or circumstances are against you, hold fast to whatever scrap of deck you can. I'll bring the Orchid alongside and grapple to her. Nothing that ship carries can stand against 100 fresh boarders."
"A fine comfort that'll be to those of us already dead or dying," Locke thought. The reality of what they were about to do had only just come home to him, and he felt an anxious fluttering in his stomach.
"Captain!"
One of the lookouts was hailing from the maintop.
"She sent up Talishani colours!"
"She might be lying," muttered Jabril. "Decent bluff. If you're going to fly a false flag, Talisham's got a bit of a navy, and nobody's at war with them right now."
Not too clever, though, said Jean. If she had escorts in sight, why not fly it at all times? Only someone with cause to be worried hides their colors.
Aye, them and pirates, Jabril grinned.
Captain Drakasha shouted across the crowd,
Del, have one of your smoke barrels sent over to the starboard rail, just forward of the quarterdeck stairs.
You want smoke from the weather rail, Captain?
A good smudge right across the quarterdeck, said Drakasha. If they want to chat with signal flags, we need an excuse to keep mum.
The lanky sailing master, holding the wheel a few feet behind Drakasha, cleared his throat loudly. She smiled, then seemed to have an idea. Turning to a sailor on her left, she said,
Get 3 signal pennants from the flag chest and let them fly from the stern. Yellow over yellow over yellow.
All souls in peril, said Jean. That's a come-hither look and no fooling.
I thought it was just a distress signal, said Locke.
Should have read the book more closely. 3 yellow pennants says we're so hard up that we'll legally grant them salvage rights to anything we don't carry on our persons. They save it, they own it.
Del Mastro and her crew had moved a smoke barrel into position at the starboard rail and lit it with a bit of twist match. Grey tendrils of smoke began to snake up and over the quarterdeck, chasing the darker black cloud rising from the lee side. At the taffrail, a pair of sailors was sending up 3 fluttering yellow pennants.
"Extra lookouts aloft and at the rails to give Mum Chance a hand," called Drakasha. "Archers up, one at a time. Keep your weapons down in the tops. Stay out of sight if you can, and play meek until I give the signal."
"Captain!"
the mainmast lookouts were shouting down once more.
"She's turned to cut our path, and she's adding sail!"
"Funny how tender-hearted they get as soon as they see that signal," said Drakasha.
"Utgar!"
A fairly young Vadran, the skin of his shaved head red-baked over a braided black beard, appeared just beside Lieutenant Del Mastro.
"Hide Paolo and Cosetta on the orlop deck," said Zamira. "We're about to cause an argument."
"Aye,"
he said, and hurried up the quarterdeck stairs.
"As for you," said Drakasha, returning her attention to the scrub watch. "Hatchets and sabres are set out at the foremast. Take your choice and wait to help send the boats down."
"Captain Drakasha!"
"What is it, Ravel?"